And we are Jim and Kathy McGinnis. Some of you we've been with during this week and some are new, so we'll just introduce ourselves. Well, I tell you what, how we wanted to do this is, I mean, this issue, as with many of these issues, is so broad, but what we thought we'd do is just attempt a simple definition of sexism and then say a couple sort of introductory things in terms of families and that definition. And then we're going to use some like case studies to elicit some of our own thinking and some of our own questions about sexism as it applies particularly to families and particularly to children and the ramifications on children. This definition...
Ignore what's on the piece of paper for now, please.
Any attitude... We're defining sexism as any attitude, action, or institutional structure that subordinates someone because of their sex. And obviously, using that kind of definition within family life, everyday life, we're always dealing with attitudes, we're always dealing with actions, and we're always dealing with the effects of institutional structures on ourselves and on our kids. And I think a lot of what we do in families, besides our own attitudes and our own actions, is sort of interpreting to kids what's going on in the outside world, interpreting the kind of messages that they are getting from other institutions, and helping them to figure out ways to counter those in terms of sexism. So if you're, I mean, examples of that would be the whole issue of it within the church, when kids might say, how come there aren't more women who are ministers? Or in our church, and we're Roman Catholic, so, you know, we deal with that a lot, where, you know, our daughter would say, why aren't there any women who are priests in this church? So there's a lot of interpreting of what's going on outside there. And then other things, like, you know, advertising, interpreting to kids what's being done in advertising in our society in terms of images of women and men. Interpreting to them as they get older, as kids get older, the whole pornography industry in this country, which has impact, obviously, on kids. That's part of it, too. And then for little ones, interpreting toys and messages they get from television. There's just a lot, I think, that comes into the family besides what kind of sort of baggage all of us carry, you know, and how we react to each other in the family. The little what we call vignettes that we have there, what we wanted to do is to take each one of those, have you read those, and then respond immediately just in pairs to each other, like what would you do in that situation. And then we're going to talk about that and sort of inductively, hopefully build up some sort of strategies for dealing with sexism within family life. So could you just look at that sheet and begin with the first one, with the story of Bobby.
Can you two share one so that we can bring them back here?
We may have to leave. We don't know if that's why we're over in the corner.
That's all right. You can be in the corner. Just read over Bobby and think about what you would do and then discuss that in pairs for a few minutes before we discuss as a whole. You can move over. It might be better to move. Okay, maybe can we come back as a whole? And I just wanted to give you all a chance to talk for a few minutes about it. I'd like for us to talk as a whole group about what you would do in that situation if it were your child, your grandchild, another child that you knew, perhaps a child that you were teaching. What would you do and why? You know, we want to get at kind of some of the things that you feel are important in this whole issue of celebrating children's potential and opening up things to them. What are some of the principles?
What would you do and why?
Well, certainly let the youngster go to dance classes if he wants to do that.
Okay.
Even though he realizes it might be an imbalance in the sexes. What difference does that make? Anybody that has seen ballet or any dancing, professional dancing of that nature, knows that it takes men and women to do the to do the program. Mm-hmm. And I would even encourage him.
Okay. So one thing in terms of a principle would be to encourage a child in whatever his or her interests are. And also what I caught in what you were saying is that as an adult to be aware of the broader picture, in this case of ballet, and who are the people that are doing it on an adult level.
Of course, once he gets into it, he might get some pressure from his book, his friends who are boys.
What do you do?
Educate him. If he gets, educate him to the fact that he may be called a sissy, I would say.
Ahead of time? Warn him ahead of time or deal with it when it comes up? Wait till it comes? Why? Why not warn him ahead of time?
Well, I think my feeling, I was just saying that one of the things, my first reaction was, well, his parents should talk with him about, how he might be perceived and all. But that seems to feed into, there's this kind of double standard between how boys and girls are treated when they're young. Like, girls can be tomboys mm-hmm. and get away with it just fine, but boys can't be effeminate at all. And it's partly this real fear of, boys being gay or something like that. And to kind of bring it up and make a big deal about it beforehand would seem to me to just be right into that kind of those stereotypes and the fear of being gay or something like that.
So you'd wait and deal with it if it came up, but you would not anticipate it.
Well, I was thinking that a couple of things the parents could do is it sounds like they aren't outright against it. They're just confused. So for one thing, maybe they could go talk to some of the ballet dancers or the teachers or something, some of the male dancers, or get themselves a little more comfortable with it, talk to people who feel good about it. And also maybe they could even, bring all the boys in the neighborhood to a ballet, if they could afford to do that, just kind of get the rest of the neighborhood kids to see something like that, since they're afraid that that's where the kid is going to stand out.
Okay, which would be being proactive on the whole issue, definitely not waiting to see. Okay. Susan, did you want to jump in?
Well, this reminds me of something that Jeremiah would do. And I would let him do it. But I think I also would just tell him that maybe some of his friends might decide to give him a hard time about it. And that he shouldn't worry about that because it's just something different from what they do. But that's for Jeremiah, because I know how he reacts to things. Mm-hmm. He comes out of things better if he's a little bit forewarned about what the risks are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So part of it then is knowing your own child, you're saying, and some kids may need to be forewarned about mm-hmm. what the risks might be.
I think one of the things that Jill said is really important to hear, and I think we're probably all aware of it, but it needs to be underlined, and that is it is easier for girls, as it were, to play like boys than it is for boys to play like girls,
In terms of typical.
That's the reality that we're dealing with. And I think we have to support young boys then in what might be an alternative form of behavior.
I'm a school teacher, of course, so this is where I'm coming from. But in the newest Scott Forsman book, there happens to be a story at fourth grade level about a boy that wanted to dance ballet, and it goes into a fairly long, complicated explanation. And boys at least read it very
openly.
Well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So if you have it, I'll just draw that out. If you have a teacher who has some materials that may be used with the kids, that may be another way besides taking kids to a ballet of bringing the discussion up.
Go to the teacher. You're a parent in that situation, enlist the teacher's support for this, again, alternative form of behavior so that the kid realizes that he's not just alone in this, that the teacher may validate the whole experience as well and introduce the possibility to other boys.
Yeah, the whole education process. We have a good friend who is a basketball coach, and his wife is a dancer. And he said one of the workouts was he brought his wife in and had her do the dance steps. Mm-hmm. And the boys were talking it out before she even broke a sweat. And I think seeing her, you know, just whip them at something was, I mean, it brought it to the light that, you know, hey, dancing isn't just for sissies. I mean, it takes a lot of strength and ability, agility, and all that.
I've used that same thing with my, again, the 8-year-old boys in jump roping. Put down the girls because they like to jump over. Hey, boxers train like that all the time.
So a step, at least a step, and I know when we've discussed this before, people say, well, do you have to justify ballet by connecting it with sports? You know, do we have to talk about Lynn Swann, the professional football player that does ballet and all that? But I think what you're saying too is a step certainly for kids could be, all right, let's look at what's really involved here, and let's look at it maybe in connection with something else that you think of as very masculine. Mm-hmm. Not very much. Go ahead, Judy.
I think this is a real extreme case, but I think that as parents, that's one of the most difficult things for us to do is to let our children grow up in the way that they, like it says in the Bible, train a child in the way he should go, not in the way I have planned, not my expectations for the child. And I know for my husband and I, that's been real difficult to let go of our dreams. It's a kind of a grieving of what we wanted for them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's what we can give to them.
Yeah.
One of the biggest gifts we can give to them is to let them be who they are. And they have to have all these little experiences when they're little. But they don't have to, but I think if you were at Holden all the time, you wouldn't have ballet and stuff. Where I live, everybody's doing ballet or playing soccer and all these things. So all the kids want to do these things. But, you know, one daughter took dance for a couple of years and never did it again, you know, because she didn't like it. And another one really excelled in it. We don't know, though, if they don't try it.
Mm-hmm.
This may be their gift. And if they don't, you know, if they don't try it, you don't know. But it's hard for us to break our dreams of what we want.
I want to go back to also to something that Jill said and just have us hear it, because she said sometimes in situations like this, parents have got to get their act together. The adults have to sort of think themselves through the thing. If we're dealing with homophobia in our own lives, I mean, we don't want to inflict that on the kids. At least I hope we don't want to inflict that on the kids. So we have to kind of work some of these things through ourselves.
The problem has to be that we do program the children from the day of the morning to the way up where they were aware of them.
So the need to be proactive to provide the alternatives.
Yeah, and we have to watch that we send the boys to from the time they're babies. We are programmed, you know, from what I think there's less of that going on now than when I was growing up. Because parents are more grounded in their hearts, you know, are accepting the fact that children should be
grounded. Yeah, I think what Judy was getting at too is to, and it's not programming so much, but it's also opening up all sorts of opportunities to kids but both sexes, so that we don't, and I think a lot of us, I know I'd say that, a lot of us sort of automatically introduce our kids to things that we think that we kind of have in our vision or our dream of them that they might want to do, you know, and maybe those things fall in very typical male-female line. So we may be introducing, generally now, I think people introduce girls to a wider range of activities. And still, I see that boys are more limited in what people will introduce them to.
Well, I can remember there were a lot of things that I liked to do that my dad would always say, well, girls don't do those things.
Yeah.
And I was a tomboy. I mean, really a hardcore tomboy, you know. Played football, basketball, whatever. The boys would be right in their fight, you know, with them. Get into wrestling matches, boxing, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a
think the answer for me is lies in the first five words here. Bobby's 7 years old. I think that's a clue. I think, you know, we're taking this very seriously, and I think a child that age should be free to explore things, and you shouldn't, I don't know if a seven-year-old, if I would sit down with them and have a serious conversation about where this may lead, isn't that going a little far ahead of this? Shouldn't they be free to enjoy and explore things at that age without thinking, well, now you know what this may lead to? You know, they're kind of young to be making any lifetime decisions here. I think it's your attitude rather than like, oh, what is this, you know? If you start sitting down and discussing this seriously, the next time they have a question, they're going to say, well, maybe this wouldn't be for me either, you know. Wouldn't you kind of squelch their enthusiasm?
So if you
make a deal off of this?
If you're, in other words, if you're saying to them, you know, what the kind of risk and what Susan was talking about that they might be taking.
They're too young. Serious discussion.
Not a serious discussion, but they're not too young to have the issue at least brought up. Your friend may call you a sissy, but let's discuss now what we could say to them. You know, I don't think that's not a serious discussion, but it's bringing the issue there. You know, especially if he's a sensitive child, you know, in her case, and will be more comfortable knowing what might happen. I mean, I can.
Susan, did you want to jump in on that? Okay.
Well, I was thinking of an instance where Jeremiah decided one morning he was going to wear a suit to school. He loves to wear a suit. Well, you know, all his friends are into t-shirts and jeans. And we didn't sit down and have a long chat with him. David just said, you know, a couple of your friends might give you a hard time. I said, well, that's okay, I just want to wear my suit. I mean, it wasn't a long discussion, it was just, we wanted to make him aware, because although you can protect your children, you can prepare them. And ostracism will not crush a child as long as they have support at home.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we just wanted to make him aware of what he might encounter, because I think the fall is worse. If you run into school and you're so happy you have your suit on, everybody laughs when you walk in the room. I mean, your fall goes like that.
Yeah.
But if you're slightly prepared that, you know, a couple of people might give you a hard time, then I don't think you fall as far.
Yeah.
There's a usage, I've never heard it put that way, but to me it makes a lot of sense. We can't protect our children, but we can prepare them to protect themselves, maybe. And there's a real important difference there.
Sure.
We have an 8-year-old grandson who lives at our house, and I've been very pleased with what he's picking up, not necessarily in the area of sexism, but not only from what he gets from us at home, but in school or someplace he's getting about not laughing or making fun of anybody because of disabilities, for instance. And he himself has to wear glasses and hearing aids, so he's had a little bit of this himself, so he's quite aware of it. Even though that's minor compared to
what
he
has.
But he has an awareness of it. And I'm thinking, well, I think it's in a very generic way that can include going to the whole sexism area too, that we don't make fun of anybody for their what they enjoy doing and so on. And I think it's, he does put it, we should not make fun of, but in a way, it can be turned positive, and we should take people for who they are and in a very positive way. The children can learn to accept each other for who they are, with their interests as well as their disabilities.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, just before we left that, because thinking of how I think somebody said girls can generally are introduced to a wide variety of things, and boys still are more narrow. And I think partly that double standard that I was thinking of may come from just there's been kind of a steady devaluation of the tasks that women do,
mm-hmm.
which are cooking, you know, if women, you know, it's that kind of lower class citizen women thing. And so if a boy does those things, you know, that's
he's
much worse
moving
than a
girl down.
Something
yeah.
that a
yeah.
man would do, because
yeah.
what men do
he's
are
moving up.
Good,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really true. I mean, it's kind of like the boy's moving down and the girl is moving up into a broader world, yeah.
For every 4 girls who would rather be a boy, there's only 1 boy who would rather be a girl. That's fruit of it.
And a lot of that for children, I think, has to do with that boys and little boys and little girls see little boys' worlds as much more exciting and much more open than a, you know, a broader kind of world. So why wouldn't you want, children's literature feeds into that. When you do, people that do a lot of analysis of children's literature, a lot of the exciting children's books are books that have boys as the main characters and the ones that are doing the exciting kinds of things. So, you know, it's kind of like, it's real pervasive.
That's true when you get to Bible stories, too. Mm-hmm. Sure. Which is the Bible
story. On children's books, if any of you have not yet picked up one of our bibliographies of children's books, we'll have them at the end. These are
yellow things here.
Are good anti-sexist books, but they're also multicultural books, and they're books that present images of nonviolence for children. And nonviolent ways to deal with conflict. So those three categories.
Sure, Susan.
One other thing is, besides for Bobby, discovering that grace and beauty are not just things for the female gender, looking a generation beyond, if Bobby grows up to be a parent, then there will be a parent who, a father who not only can play catch, maybe drive a construction machine, mm-hmm. but can also dance. And so there'll be a different kind of model then
for the next generation
of children, yeah. of a more balanced emphasis, both the receptive and the aggressive, active
type of thing. Yeah, it's true, so looking at that way. One last thing before we leave the Bobby thing. If, kind of taking this story a little bit farther, if Bobby goes and then comes home and says, some of the other kids are making fun of me, they're calling me a sissy, they're calling me a fag, whatever kinds of words he's hearing, I don't want to do it anymore. Then what do you do? What would you do as a parent in that situation?
Probably put the question back to them and ask them.
So helping him to look a little bit deeper into his own feelings. I think this gets at the question of risk-taking behavior.
Mm-hmm. I think it goes back to that preparation, too, that she was talking about. If the child knows he's going to face this, and maybe if he's thought about it and has some answers to his friends, we'll call him a fag or whatever, mm-hmm. then he's not going to have the same bad feeling.
Okay. At least he's gone through it and prepared, and maybe
he may find he doesn't like dance anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, right. He may decide he doesn't like it.
But
period.
It shouldn't be on the basis of being ridiculed.
Mm-hmm. And also I think, I mean, it seems to me part of this too is to really, if that situation occurs, to acknowledge to the kid that it's hard to be different. This is real, you know, you've kind of chosen a path here, and not, I'm not saying say, but and you have to stick with it, because he may not be ready to stick with it, but to acknowledge the choice that he's made.
This brings us back to the topic of the first session, those of you who were with us, in terms of self-esteem, how important it is to build up children's self-esteem, to make them feel good about themselves from the earliest years on, so that they may have the courage to be different. Because if they don't have a good sense of themselves, they won't find the courage to be different. And we want people to be different not only at age 7, but to grow into parenthood.
I mean, I think maybe, you know, maybe we'd say, okay, that's fine, we'll take you to some concerts still, maybe in a couple of years you'll want to do it again. And I sure think I would, you know, particularly if the kids were calling the kid a fag or something, I would take that opportunity to mention, if possible, that, you know, hey, some of my friends are you mm-hmm. know, fags or something. I explain, you know, kind of play that down, because that's a stereotype that I think can be built up just at a really early age, you know, against gays.
Sure.
But other than that, you know, after maybe giving them a little talk and explaining through it, then saying, that's fine if you don't call her anymore. Mm-hmm.
But there is also the strategy that you raised yourself, and that is, if Bobby may be able to handle the situation if he gets support from, and it may be as simple as saying, Bobby, would you like to invite a couple of your friends to go to a ballet with us, or whatever it is, and that, you know, building that kind of introducing other kids to the richness of the experience may help to overcome that.
The more I think about it, though, the better I like a proactive approach rather than the, you know, maybe taking other kids to the valley is okay. Maybe discussing some of the, I mean, everybody kind of sitting on both sides of the issue here is a better day, you know, kind of get some kids some preconceived notions and so that their expectations are fulfilled, which may not be positive, as opposed to preparing them. Maybe it is really wise to prepare them. I think what Susan said, that I think, you know, if a child knows what he's up against before he gets there, it makes it much easier for him to cope with it.
And may enable him not to want to give up on it quite as quickly.
Right, whereas he may be crushed, you know, if he goes someplace and then it just comes down.
Interesting. I don't know that there's a right answer, but it's.
If I had a different child, I might choose a different way.
Yeah, and it gets back to what you were saying initially, knowing your own child. One resource just to mention to you that I'm sure a lot of you know and have used, especially those of you with young children or that teach, is the video Free to Be You and Me, which came out years and years ago. But even older kids kind of like it, you know, not just
my kids still listen to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's a record and all that, but the video is very accessible and is in a lot of school libraries. And the little segment on William Wants a Doll, I think, can provoke really good discussions with even little kids about, it's a little different than this scenario, but what are appropriate playthings for kids? And for kids to really talk about, you know, have kids list what they think are good playthings for girls and boys, and are there some things that both can play with, are there some things that one shouldn't play, you know, why do you think, and so they can provoke all that.
This is a really fruitful area for grandparenting, I think.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, little girls like dolls, but little boys, as far as I'm concerned, that, my observation, sure like teddy bears.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But William had a doll.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. Let's go to the story of Sandra, which is a little different kind of thing, and ask you to read that, and then again in pairs. Okay, can we come back as a whole group?
Yeah, they weren't out at the airport a minute. Yeah, they were. But the championship handed.
This issue is I would dare to say that cheerleading is one of the most influential subcultures in terms of children and young adolescents in our lives and still is, you know, and there is a sort of a whole subculture to it. And there's some similarities in this to the story of Bobby, but some differences, I think, too. So what would you do in that kind of situation if you were either the parent or, we do this sometimes with kids and say, well, if this were your friend, what would you do? Something.
Well, I grew up probably a little older than a lot of you. I was in coaching for a little while, and boys and girls basketball back in Iowa. Iowa still played in girls basketball with five or with six. So you play your guard or your forward, and only three of them can shoot, and you know, that sort of thing. And when I
they still use those rules. Yeah. They still use those rules.
Still
does
that.
Wow.
And when I coached basketball, there would be times when the person who assisted with the girls' basketball would come and say, this girl can't play this week. Well, that doesn't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of situation has changed. But from the time I coached until now, girls basketball has opened up. All girls sports have opened up more. My daughter was a cheerleader, and that's all she could be. And she was an aggressive girl, and would have liked to participate in other kinds of sports, but they didn't have girls basketball where we were at that, when she was growing up at that time. But now she's married and she has two daughters, and her husband was an athlete, and he didn't have any sons. So the girls played softball, became very good at it in the summer, and volleyball, and the older girl is on high school volleyball.
Let me break in. What do you do in this situation? Let's focus on this situation that you were reading about. What do you do in this case study as a parent?
In this case, I certainly would be in sympathy with the girl. The situation may be different, but I guess I would certainly try to get her out of that particular situation. I would agree.
You'd try to get her out.
Try to get her out of making cookies, and I've never seen that happen. I didn't know that girls made cookies for the boys.
It's a true story.
This is a true story.
Yeah.
That wouldn't sit with me at all.
Okay, so here's a parent
said. All New York, they're still doing cupcakes and cookies for the boys. And
parent
the girls
says,
do
yeah,
nothing.
I would get my kid out. Okay.
Okay.
Other responses.
Okay, Jay, did you want to?
It is a true story, and it's happening this year. That's the worst part.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I would suggest her. You know, if she wants to be on the squad, that's fine. But she doesn't want to do what's required of being on the squad. Try to change that, or get into a sport. You know, change the what the cheerleaders are doing. You know, try to influence them. Try to say, hey, boys aren't making us cookies. We don't need to do that. I mean, 1991, let's change.
Who's the noun? I don't hear. I heard all the verbs,
hey,
but no nouns.
The girls. The her daughter. The daughter.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying you as the parent would.
Oh. Suppose they can do help out.
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, that's part of the question.
That's the question.
Part, yeah.
What do you do as a parent?
Yeah.
Is this something that you intervene in and take an active role in, or is this something that you let the daughter do? Where do you?
I guess a parent would have to.
Sure. Well, girls' basketball in Iowa is a lot different than a lot of other places.
Yeah.
Because that you can go to boys and girls basketball in Iowa, and the girls' game is first, and the crowd is there.
Yeah.
And the boys play, half the people
play. I would.
Well, okay. Let's get back to this case.
Yeah.
Let's get back to this case.
Yeah.
I guess I would try to. First of all, she's new on the cheerleading squad, so it's very difficult to come in as a newcomer and just tell everybody what they're doing wrong.
Okay.
And I don't think that would be what I would advise her to do, but I would advise her to start going to the student council. And maybe trying to increase the role of the cheerleading squad so it was cheerleading also for the girls' sports. Or, you know, to try to teach her the different systems in the school that she could go through first to try to change this. Okay.
So you'd intervene. You'd give it, you'd intervene with advice and very specific advice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Based on your own knowledge of how school systems work,
yeah,
and what, you know, maybe this.
But I don't think at the initial point I would get involved vocally as a parent, because if she's the one who wants to make the changes, then I want her to try to do it first.
Herself.
Okay.
Judy?
The first thing I thought of when I read this was a very mature look of a 15-year-old, and I would certainly affirm that. You know, I think you're looking at things, you know, a couple years above your and affirm that with her. And then I would support her and encourage her, but I would let her, 15 years old, I think that, you know, if this is important enough, and they certainly are dumb things, I gotta admit, you know, and there are things that, and you know, maybe she would choose then not to be a cheerleader, and help her look at herself and see how far she would go. You know, where are your boundaries? What is it that you are willing to do, and what are you willing not to do?
So part of that is the question of change within a system, or then do you opt out of a system if you can't figure out how to change it, or if it won't change?
Well,
after you've tried.
Or are you willing to do what you have to do?
What you have to do, yeah.
To make a change.
Yeah.
That was my thought. I wondered, you know, did she get in there and then find out about the cookies? That's not too likely, I wouldn't think, but you wonder, you know, why she chose to participate in
some. Probably found out after the fact, maybe in some of it, I don't know.
Maybe.
That particular one.
I have several thoughts going through my mind. One is, I agree with Susan McLean, who is just saying that with the child, I would want to support this child, but also, since I have been in many situations where I've been the new person on the block and just jumped in and been a little ramrod, I know what effect that has, and it doesn't work. So I think I would like to give, you know, a little bit of advice just from experience to say, well, there are several different approaches, or ask her what she thinks her approaches are first, actually, and then if she hasn't thought of some of them, I might say, well, you might want to think about this as well. But what's been going through my head is, if this is an all-girl cheerleading squad, or if they're boys on this cheerleading squad.
All girls. Yeah.
Because I don't know if in colleges and pro sports, I think they have males and females who are supporting the teams anymore.
Pro? Not on the pro football.
Oh.
The Laker girls.
It is.
Yeah.
It
what
is.
Do they call those Dallas Cowgirls?
Dallas
But college.
College.
Yeah.
College, it's mixed.
But why I'm bringing this up is, I remember when I was going through junior high and high school, they did have that small squad that would go support the girls' sports. And it sounds like what she's looking for is a big squad. And I wonder, in 1991, in Seattle, Washington, if there wouldn't be, sports are a pretty big deal, and basketball is a very, women's basketball is a very big deal in that city, if there wouldn't be boys who would also be interested in this. And this sort of gets away from, off the track of what her parents would say. But I see that there's a lot of room for change in the situation, and she could be a real change agent. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not today, in her, you know, her first day on the squad, but maybe a year from now, and dropping little kids here and there.
Well, maybe too, what I'm hearing you say, and Susan say too implicitly, is to help her maybe analyze the whole structure a little bit, and what is it that you really find offensive in this, and is part of it that it's just girls that are doing it, that are doing all these supportive things of boys. Would you feel differently if there were girls and boys both baking cookies and putting stars on the locker? Or is it the whole idea of having to, of exalting athletes that much, you know? I realize that some 15-year-olds, if you started talking about that, would think, what are you talking about? You know, what? I just know that I don't quite... But that kind of helps them, I think, to be a little more critical, too, about it. Or is it the inequity of why is it that boys' sports seem to be given much more importance than girls' sports? Is that, or are all three of those things a problem, you know? And to just maybe in a conversation help her, rather than our telling her, what would always be my problem would be I'd want to lay my analysis of the system on her right away rather than trying to get from her what her analysis is, what she finds problematic.
This issue brings me back to something that you said earlier, Judy, and I don't know how to deal with it exactly. Teresa, our daughter, who's here, has this real passion for cheerleading. And when she was going into high school, that's what she was talking about. She's also a tremendous athlete. And we saw her going to give up on playing sports in order to be the cheerleader. And I think our analysis was that it would put her out there in the kind of dress and appearance mode to be noticed by especially boys. that she wanted to be. And I thought that that was, in a sense, giving up something that she was really gifted at for something less good. And I wasn't willing to let her do that, even though that's what she wanted. And what we came to was, Teresa, you can be a cheerleader for one of the sports only if you are a participant in a sport. And I don't know how you what kind of a judgment you would make on that, but I did not want her to give up on something that she was gifted at and enjoyed, and truly enjoyed. So in a sense, that was my imposed solution on the situation, that I made the cheerleading conditional.
Well, that's just, and I'm not sure how this figures into it, but the other element that's different in this one from Bobby's is that she's 15 years old, and it's boys and girls, and there's this kind of courty romance thing that's going on then. And I don't quite know how that would shift the dynamics of this whole thing, but somehow it seems like it would.
Oh, yeah,
And you're talking about, your daughter wants to be seen by the boys.
Well, also,
that's
something
you should discourage. Mm-hmm.
Mostly cheerleaders are the crowd, aren't they? I mean, that's a social thing, also.
True.
A cheerleader is to be really part of the social.
I guess I remember the head cheerleader in my high school, and she was also a very fine violin player. We were in a quartet together, and she went on and majored in music, and another cheerleader was just one of the nicest people you could ever meet. So I didn't have the stereotype of cheerleader. I mean, we tried to impose that stereotype of cheerleader to the head job and, you know, just going along and being real socialized and all of this, and they were really very gifted in their own ways too, and also chose to do this, and that was, I think, a real good role model for others following in the cheerleading footsteps.
I like what you said, because I think it's so easy for us to be prejudiced against the cheerleaders and say just because they're out there dancing around and want to be popular, that's wrong. And that may be something that they just really like to do, and that's something that's very meaningful to them. And I think it's very hard. I think as parents, you need to lead your children down, let them go where their gifts are taking them, but you also have to, like you're doing there, and each situation is different. I think that you probably came up with a nice balance. Balance is important. And I think it's important in all of this, too, to not, if you go too far saying that the girls are not being able to do all the things the boys are, you come out of balance in the sense that a girl is a wonderful thing too, and to celebrate the fact that being a girl, you know, I mean, most girls don't play football because they're not big enough, you know, physically. But I just see that there needs to be a balance in all of this, and it's individual people, and that's why it's so hard to be a parent. You have to be such a student of your child. I mean, you have to just study them.
And each kid is different.
Yeah, and each one of your children are different. And so it's hard to just give a black and white answer. But I think balance is real important. And I think we can get out of balance in situations like this so easy and make it look like the cheerleader was the dumb one and the one that's playing basketball was, you know, or vice versa. You know, what a dumb girl you are wanting to play basketball. Why aren't you like all the others wanting to be a cheerleader? I mean, either extreme is not helping them.
I think, now, you mentioned that you had a restriction, and I thought, boy, my daughters would never have gone for that, saying that if you're going to do this, you have to do that. Because then, in a sense, you're saying, if you do this to please yourself, you're going to have to do this to please me, to get my approval. I won't approve of you doing this unless you do this. And is that, I don't know. As I said, I wouldn't have ever thought of doing that, saying that if you want to do this, then you're going to have to do this, because in a sense you are imposing on them something of your own, of your own dreams and aspirations. And I have found that my children continually surprised me, and they would say, I'm going out, my daughter said, I'm trying out for a play, I'm like, play. I mean, I immediately thought of myself being involved in this, you know. And I was not involved in any way. And she got the lead role in her first play. And I thought, I can't imagine you even being good at that, you know. Mm-hmm. And here I had this kid for 14 years.
That's true.
And never dreamed occurred, that this was. And I thought, believe me, I'm staying out of all these things. You make your choice if you want to quit your instruments or take instruments. It's your choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm here if you fall on your face, and I'll help you, but I think it's hard for parents to make restrictions or conditions, because you are, in a sense, saying, hey, in order to make me feel good on this, you've got to
To be really honest about the situation, I think it was more of a negotiating position that I went into the discussion with rather than an absolute hard and fast, you can't, because I do think you're right. But
that's,
I think there is but there is the dilemma of when you recognize your kid's giftedness and you see them opting not to pursue it, and where do you...
If they don't love it, they won't.
Not everybody, I guess, loves their kids. One area I've noticed is I can't count how many people have said they're so sorry they gave up practicing their piano or their instrument. And they wish their parents would have
made them.
Get up again, though. Yeah. You know,
but they don't.
It's so hard, though, as an adult. Being a musician, having taught some children, if they don't have real parent support, the parents sitting with them and helping them those first 2 years, when it's a real struggle.
That's what I mean, depending on the method. You know, you gotta balance.
But it's real easy for the parents to say, well, you know, you're doing it, you make the choice. They're going to make, often they make the choice not to continue because it's very hard.
Hard, because it's hard.
They're already doing sports and they're already doing
that's
their
exactly
sports.
What I meant by a balance. You have to have a balance of pushing and a balance of supporting and a balance of encouragement.
I think the other question with cheerleading, though, and what Jim was getting at a little bit, is cheerleading can be, for some girls, can be a way to sort of heighten their concern about their appearance and how they dress and how they look and how the boys will react to them.
Do you think it's any different, though, if they weren't a cheerleader?
Well, no, but I not necessarily, but I think what may be, and at the bottom of what you were saying too, is if you have concerns that your daughter may be overly interested in that, as in one level a lot of teenage girls are, then you're hesitant to encourage her to pursue an activity that's kind of focused on that when there may be another activity that's counter to, you know, she can't do both at the same time, that helps her develop some other aspects of herself rather than... Now, some kids, I think, do go into cheerleading, and, you know, you have to be able to do certain gymnastic kinds of things on many squads. So it can be an athletic kind of thing, I think, but for a lot of girls, it's not really that. It's much more the appearance and how the boys will perceive them, and so that...
I think that's true.
But I wouldn't
want to see my daughter on the top of the pyramid.
That's true.
I don't want mine on the bottom of it.
I think the leadership skills too. I mean, and the social, getting in front of a large.
Sure.
Crowd.
Oh yeah. No, that's all good.
There are
there's
some
good.
Real good.
Good.
Yeah. Things.
Yeah, it's not for my daughter.
Yeah.
No. When I was in high school, the cheerleaders were elected. Is that the way in where we
tryouts?
My girls, it's tryouts, and they're judged by a board of people that come in from the outside. Yeah. So there's nobody that even knows these girls. Is that the way it's done all over?
It's
judged in our school by the gym teacher.
By the gym teacher, I mean.
Well, there's a committee.
A moderator.
But it's a local.
Yeah, from our school, but it's like student council, teachers.
And there's no more elections anymore. I mean, there isn't at that school.
There's still some popularity connected to it, so I don't know how.
It's that time, gang. We've got to wrap it up. If any of you want more in terms of children's books, again, the bibliography, if you're looking more for some of our ideas, we keep saying this at the end of each session, there's three books in the bookstore, one for parents with preschoolers, elementary age, and then teens, where all three of the books have some good sections, good chapters on this whole issue, in case you're interested.
And I'm just going to mention these worksheets, just to put them here in case you want one. This is a worksheet that's called Who Does What, and it just looks at common everyday tasks around the home. It's kind of we think one way to just look at what we usually do around the home, especially if there's a male and female role model somewhere for kids, whether it's a parent or a grandparent or an uncle or aunt or something. And what do the kids see by how we divide tasks and how we respond to them? And are there any aspects of that that we ourselves would like to change without judging? You know, we always get real careful when you do this stuff and say, you know, not judging and saying it's better if you do it this way or it's better if you do it that way. But so if you're interested in taking one of those just for something to look at and think about or talk about, do that too. Well, let's put these on
the table. We'll put them on the table. If you don't want the vignettes, give them back and we can pass them out the next time we do this. If you want to keep them for some reason, feel free to do that.